All right, everyone. Here I am. I have John Mark with me. So, John Mark, would you like to say hello?
Hello, everyone. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, and I just want to check and make sure you all can hear him okay, or if I need to make any changes on my end for the sound. Okay, it looks like they're saying the sound is all good, so that's wonderful. So just before I took the mic, John Mark was asking me where I am physically. I'm in Pueblo, Colorado.
Oh, cool.
And why don't you
let me know.
Why don't you tell us where you are? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm presently in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh, then you're just down the road.
Yeah. Oh, well, cool.
Yeah, there's only like one or two, even though you're about 4.5 hours away, there's only one or two towns between us.
Oh, well, then that is right next door, really, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, we're neighbors.
In the mind of God, we can't ever be far. I've been called to this area. There's some land called the Temple Canyon Sanctuary that's kind of part of the Way of Mastery pathway.
Yes.
And I don't know, maybe 6 weeks ago, Yeshua invited me to be here and invite others to join over this dates of the September 26th, 27th, and 28th. So I'm going to be holding a vortex with about 30 other beings who have answered his invitation to come, and we're going to camp out there under the stars and just see what happens.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. But a little bit just real quickly about me. I've been an avid student and playmate of spirit. Since about 2006, something in my being started making that inner turn away from the world, frustrated that why doesn't life work the way the world's taught me it would work. Quickly, the Course in Miracles came into my awareness. I began to hear an inner voice when, just like the Course said, I was like, wow, this is really cool. I mean, it says you're going to hear this voice. I was hearing the voice. And over time, my relationship with that voice deepened. It wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 2 years later that the authority of that voice, which I call Yeshua, I know in the Course he's known as Jesus, kind of revealed that he was the source of what I'd been hearing. I had always thought, well, it's just the Holy Spirit kind of thing. But, you know, I listened to that inner guide, and I did what the inner guide told me to do, not in a submissive way, but in a exploring the nature of my own consciousness and how I had used it to create my unique, particular proclivity of separation. And all of that was incredibly and powerfully and miraculously healing for me. So my life is love. I don't own a home anymore. I'm home free. We sold our home back in May, and I just moved where the Spirit would have me be. I'm here in Abiquiu, Santa Fe, for this thing. I don't know where I'll be next, but I just go wherever love would have me be.
Now,
it's a lot of fun.
I have a personal question then. Can we just dive right in with the personal questions?
Sure. And by the way, any question is perfectly okay.
All right. So my personal question is, at least I was under the impression that you had a wife. Do you still have a wife?
I have what I would call a playmate, a partner. I could never claim her as a wife anymore.
Okay.
I mean, the way the world defines that with possession and exclusivity, I am in joyful communion with an absolutely free and sovereign Christed being, and we choose to play together.
All right.
And as long as that serves the two of us, as long as it expresses as a holy relationship, fabulous. But should that no longer be the case, then she is absolutely free, and she knows I'm sovereign and free, and I will follow my guidance, whatever that may be.
And so is she then, the way you're speaking is beautiful. If I was speaking to her, would she say it the same way? Is she on this open spiritual path? Is she also really realizing, or is she still more involved in the world? What's going on there?
No, she would probably describe our relationship with you in the same way.
Okay.
I had a pretty rapid and deep awakening, which was pretty illuminating for me and quite traumatic for her. So she's come to this in her own time and in her own way. But she's now, you know, deeply immersed in the self-discovery of her own divinity and opening to how that will give expression through her. She's much more kind of engaged in things that we might call the world than really suits me anymore, but that's perfectly fine. That's her pathway, and I honor, you know, how she's coming to it.
Okay. Well, tell us.
Go ahead.
Now you go ahead.
It's just not very loving to insist to someone that we say we love that they need to change.
I 100% agree with you on that one.
Yeah, all I could do and all my inner being told me was simply love her in her wholeness. And that's the greatest gift I could give her, whenever she chooses to whatever degree she chooses to accept it, and to whatever degree I realize or experience it or discover it.
Yes.
So it's really illuminating. It's not relationship like it's anything I ever knew, but it violates all the world's laws, and my mind used to tell me this would be a disaster, but oh, it's so much fun. It's so free and so light. It just really is something. So her and I's relationship through, because we were married for 30 years, not 30 years. We've been together for 30 years, maybe married for 25 or something when all this began happening for me. So we did special relationship as perfect as anybody could do it. I mean, you know, we played the codependent game, the guilt game, the manipulation game, the shame game, the use the kids against each other game, you name it, we did it. So it's like we took the special relationship sponge and we squeezed every drop out of it. And now we get to release that sponge and allow spirit to fill that. And it's been beyond anything I ever could have even conceived was possible.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit then about, your awakening experience. So like we have the old John Mark, right? Mm-hmm. And then something begins to stir in your soul. And then at some point, for lack of better words, there's a new, completely different John Mark. You know, if somebody who knew the old John Mark ran into you, they would perceive a change. Can we talk a little bit how you went from the old John Mark to the new John Mark, some of what you went through?
Sure. Let me see where the spirit's going to begin.
Sure.
I was the epitome. I could have been the poster boy for the American dream. Everything I touched in the world was kind of gold. I could manifest in the world. I was really successful, had a 10-year career in corporate America, really, really successful, won like manager of the year for the company that I worked for. Then I was like, gosh, I really want to do this on my own. I don't want to work for anybody else. Then I went and started a small business that became a world leader in its little, in the niche that I was in my little hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. We kind of rewrote the books of what would be possible in business. So I had the American dream, 2 houses, boat, airplane, you name it, anything that the world said would bring you joy and peace and status symbol and all that stuff that's part of the American dream. I got it all, but something was missing. So I got more. Thinking, well, more will do it. Sure, you know, it can't be that it hadn't occurred to me the whole flawed system of the world. I didn't think to question that. It harkens me back to a moment I had in my mid-20s. I mentioned that I had won an award for being manager of the year for this big corporation. And I had really wanted it. I mean, it's been like one of those goals, set the goal, work your ass off, achieve. Well, I had gotten the award, and I gave some speech. I said something. And as I was walking off the stage, when I got to the 4th step, it's like in an instant, Regina, out of nowhere, I was cast into what I would call the deepest, darkest emptiness of just futility and despair. Out of nowhere, from the height of success to this, I now realize that was my soul pretty much going, yeah, there's nothing for you here. This is all empty. You think it's great, but it's just empty. It will only lead to this. I had no idea what it was. It scared the shit out of me. Scared me to death. I spent the next 15 years running from that fear, running from it. And that fear actually propelled me more into the world to try and fill this that sense of deep emptiness. It's not like I lived with it all the time, but I couldn't forget it. I knew it was there. It was just like kind of gnawing at me. So finally, after about 15 years of great success, this something just, it wasn't going to go away, the fear of this. And then one day it just occurred to me, this is going to kill me one way or the other, so I might as well turn towards it. I might as well turn within and see what this really is, because I can't keep this up anymore. I can't pedal fast enough to keep away from it. So that was a, I don't know, you might call that one of those dark nights of the soul or whatever, where we kind of make the turn. At the time, I had no idea what it was. I sold my business, which was largely my identity, and I began a reluctant, very reluctant, very tentative kind of inward movement. I tried some new business things. They all fell flat. I lost a lot of money because it was just like my soul was going, nope, we're not going back here. This just isn't going to work. It's going to work. It's going to work. So finally, Cindy and I were in a really, really vicious argument, and it got violent. And we both of us hit each other. And I remember that night laying in my bed full of so much shame and guilt. Oh, I couldn't take it. I was like, so for the first time in probably a really long time, I prayed what to me felt really authentic. Help, help. Something's really wrong here. Help. 2 weeks later, the first girl I ever kissed, like a sixth grade friend, shows up in my life. Haven't seen her in decades. She drops the Course in Miracles in my lap and totally disappears. I think most of us have some crazy miracle about how the Course showed up. So I began trying to read the Course, and the Course was like, what the fuck is this saying? So I got Disappearance of the Universe. Well, that put a context around it for me. So I'm really grateful for Gary's work. That put a context around it. And all of a sudden, it really started to speak to me. And immediately, I started the lessons. And like 3 or 4 lessons in, I could just feel my whole being like, ooh. You know, even though the lessons were driving my mind crazy, I could feel something that was just kind of drawing me in. So I remember telling Cindy, I have no idea what this book is, but I'm doing it. And it'd be cool if you do it with me, but I'm doing it nonetheless. So that was kind of the first movement of me going, specialness isn't going to do it anymore. I've got to find truth. So I was doing the lessons and beginning the lessons. And there's a movement called Oneness. Have you heard about it? Where yeah. They do the Diksha blessing, yeah. The Oneness blessing. So by some crazy set of circumstances, Cindy had had clinical depression for like 10 years. So I had really become an expert at witnessing what depression is and what it looks like. So we had tried all kinds of medical stuff and nothing was working. So finally we were going to do this neurofeedback kind of thing. So I was so suspicious at this point because, of course, every doctor said, oh, yeah, we can heal this. And, of course, it was never healed, only because Cindy didn't have any interest in healing, really. But so we got hooked up with this neurobiologist, and he was a oneness trainer or blessing giver or whatever. He invited us, so we both went. And I remember thinking, what the hell have I gotten myself into? What are these people doing? They're running around putting hands on the head. I was totally freaked out. I mean, this was just spirituality had never been really on my radar. So I was a little overwhelmed, but I could feel something. And I kept kind of going back to that oneness thing. And it was really in that oneness thing where I first started to hear awakening. I'm like, what the fuck are they talking about? I woke up this morning. What is this awakening business? So at the time, the Course says, ask the Holy Spirit. So I was like, okay. All right, Spirit, if you're there, what is this awakening? And I hear a reply, and the reply says, you're not who you think you are. And I said, well, really? Well, then who am I? And the reply was, that's what our communion will reveal to you. And I was like, wow. I couldn't believe it. So then I said, can I ask more questions? And the voice said, sure, you can ask anything you want. And I said, I want this to be quick, painless, and fun. Because I had been around that little oneness group, and it's like, there was a lot of suffering. I mean, I hadn't really realized how much I had been suffering in my life, but I said, I want quick, I want painless and I want fun. And the Spirit said, the truth is true right now, and it's the only thing that will ever be true. Was that quick enough? And I was like, yeah. Of course, I had no idea what truth was, right. But I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. Thanks. And then and the Spirit said, if you're ever in pain or distress of any kind, to include doubt, then you're mistaken. Simply let it go and remember that the truth is only true now. I thought, well, that sounds simple enough. And then for the fun one, I didn't so much as hear an answer, but I felt and heard this huge roaring laughter in my awareness. So my pathway pretty much went down that road pretty quick, pretty painless, because I realized I'd been told if I'm hurting, let go. And I would, and I would ask the Spirit, and the Spirit would kind of show me or illuminate what was going on. And I had an extraordinary amount of fun. I did movies with the Spirit and all kinds of cool stuff that we shared in that communion, which more than anything, I mean, the voice taught me metaphysics. It taught me the theology of the Course, the right-minded thought system. It showed me stuff mystically, but the simplest and most profound thing was the relationship taught me what love was. The relationship with that voice is what really revealed to me the nature of love. It wasn't something I got intellectually, although there was lots of mind illumination. It was the relationship that the Spirit had with me. There was never any judgment. There was never any doubt. There was only certainty about who I was. There was only truth. There was only patience. I mean, it was perfect. I mean, I was never asked one time, I asked about, oh, am I supposed to make some leap of faith? And the Spirit said, well, no, why would I ask you to do that? That would only frighten you. Give me whatever trust you're willing, and I'll show you I'm worthy of that, and then you can give me more. We'll do this on your trust willingness schedule. And I thought, well, that sounds really reasonable. And, of course, I began to really recognize that voice versus the one in my head, which was saying, oh, you're supposed to be this, you're supposed to be that. So the discernment and the relationship is what really revealed to me the nature of love through relationship. It's really, really cool. So anyway, it happened pretty quickly. I went to Oneness University in India for a month, doing my course lessons while I was over there, which was breaking one of their rules, by the way, which I kind of like that. You know, the more rules we break, usually the more we're waking up. But in the cab on the way from Oneness University to the airport to catch my flight home, little red cab, in an instant, out of nowhere, and words can't really do anything to describe it, but it was this moment of infinite expansiveness, infinite love, infinite beingness, the world radiating just nothing but love, no mind to be found anywhere. It's like in that instant, my whole identity, my mind got wiped clean. So I come. That experience lingers. I mean, it never fully left, but staying in that incredibly expanded state did not contract like to be lost, but something began a transition of that becoming embodied and lived here.
Understand.
So I got home from the plane. My wife had put me on John Mark on the plane to go home, and this empty body came back. I knew who they were, but there wasn't lots of mind activity. I was kind of like 6 or 8 weeks of, I wouldn't say being vegetable, but there just wasn't anything cognitive there. But I could still feel the presence of the Spirit, but I could feel it and knew it now. It's not like it had to talk to me anymore. It didn't have to use symbols like words. It was just an inner knowing. So for those 8 weeks, I pretty much just sat in silent meditation in this communion. I think some of the other pathways call it sat, where they're sitting in the presence, in the beingness, in the flow. So I just did that for about 8 weeks, and it was very disorienting for me and for my family. know, they were like, what the hell happened? Cindy thought I had gotten some kind of virus over there. And, you know, she was going to have to take care of me my whole life, because I'd taken a shower one morning. I was in the closet, and she was, I was just like one with everything. So there was no need to dress. There was no need to dry off, no nothing. I mean, I didn't feel a compunction. It was just, it was all just was what it was. So she comes in and, oh, do you need help? I'm like, yeah, maybe so. So anyway, after those 8 weeks were up, it's kind of like something new came online. But it was, you could call it my Christ self or the higher self, whatever's descending began to rise into awareness. And it did include thought. But it was different than the egoic thought in the past. It's not like a state of no thought, but it was a state of what you might call holy thought, right-mindedness. So for 18 months after that, and at this point, it was revealed that that voice was Yeshua. So for 18 months, he and I went back through all of his pathways. We did the entire Course in Miracles again, not as a student, but really in communion with the Christ who had birthed it. So, I mean, it felt like it was me birthing it with him. It wasn't a real separate thing. So we did that with the Course in Miracles, the Course of Love, the Way of Mastery. And meanwhile, we were doing Waking Up to the Movies, he and I, all at the same time. So I was having this just... Now, I've been told by him that my experience of awakening is a little unusual. Usually they come on more gradually than mine, but... The Spirit had cleared my life. I didn't have a business. I had some financial resources, so it could all happen really quickly. And, of course, it fit my quick, fun, and painless thing. So then that went on for about 18 months, and then he invited me one morning to go to my first Course in Miracles meeting group. I've never known what that was. He said, sure, here's three in your local area. Go and just announce that you're awake when you get there. I had no idea what I was being set up for. I had no clue what I was being set up for. Because I thought, well, this is the whole point, is this awakening thing. Well, I went in and I got projected on like nobody's business. And I remember going out of the thing and just hearing laughter in my extended awareness, you know, just laughter about the whole thing. So that's kind of how my public expression after that period of kind of abiding in the truth, embodying presence, taking on the consciousness of the teachings that had birthed them. Then that began a 2.5-3 year period of this massive creative expression about teachings around the Course, teachings around the Way of Mastery, sharing of the Waking Up to the Movies. So that's kind of how it happened for me.
Okay.
I would encourage everybody, if you've been on the long, slow, painful path, there is another way. It doesn't have to be that way. But that doesn't mean you don't do the work. The work still has to take place.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what I was going to ask you next. I was going to ask you if you could pick any circumstance of work, any circumstance, or maybe it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that quick, fast, easy, where it took some kind of work on your part, and share that story with us.
That actually would be, hello. That actually
would be. That's my roommate, Danielle.
When my teaching began.
Yeah.
Because the subtlety of spiritual ego, especially now in a teaching capacity, it's a whole new level of beings. One I could never have even approached until I had had some measure of awakening and now began the extension of Christ consciousness. Nothing in my life had ever prepared me for the temptations that can arise when beings are prepared to give you their enlightenment. Because it's not just fear and guilt and shame that we project. We project truth or power or enlightenment onto other beings. So as I began to teach and the Spirit was moving through me, and sometimes with miraculous power, people wanted to make this body the source of that. And I saw in my own mind the temptation to be identified as the one that is something special about this body. I could never have gotten to that stage had teaching not been the next thing. So it's kind of like once that came, deeper, more subtle temptations that I had not seen yet in my awareness began to arise. So learning more deeply how to see only the truth in another, no matter what they're saying or doing, and trying to give you their power. Because we're so desperate to give our power away, because that's how we stay victims. You know, when we have to take responsibility for our power, and if there's someone who's awake, it's really, that's how you get the whole guru thing going, where people are now worshiping the guru instead of what the guru's embodying, which is that one source. So I had some work to do there. And I don't know what I haven't seen yet. So my own experience is that for me, there was a big threshold that never closed. But awakening is a ceaseless thing.
Okay.
There's greater and greater subtleties and greater nuance in this infinitely mysterious and powerful thing that we call God or consciousness or I am-ness. And as I discover that, I also discover more intimately how I had distorted it in my past, or how easy and tempting it would be to distort it. Because when you can perceive so clearly another's divinity and how they're expressing it within their egoic consciousness, it would be super easy to manipulate.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's happened in some spiritual communities where, you know, that kind of thing goes on. That's the most recent aspect. And that work is one of increasing vigilance. Yeshua mentions in the Way of Mastery that the deeper we go into God, the greater the need for vigilance, not less. And I know a lot of perceptions, I certainly held the perception, oh, awakening will happen and then there won't be a need for anything.
It's over, you're done.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, over and done. Yeah, bullshit on that. Greater vigilance, because of course you're now dealing with greater power. More light can flow through you. Your consciousness is more expanded. You can perceive more accurately because the distorted filters of the self have been healed or released or forgiven or whatever name you want to put on it. So it can be really, you know, it's really tempting to become a peeker. A curiosity to know what's going on with them, and just like get nosy in other people's sovereignty just because you now have some expanded awareness, rather than that being exclusively a movement of spirit or a movement of love.
So how do you keep yourself humble? What happens within you to keep yourself from falling for these temptations, which, as we know, really so many people have?
Many of them, I stepped right in them. I mean, you know, you don't actually see it until you see it. And, you know, it can be quite embarrassing when you see, oh, my God, what I was doing. You know, forgiveness usually comes with a nice dose of embarrassment or humility for what you might call the spiritual ego. So it's not getting complacent. Recognizing that of myself, I can do nothing. All things that happen through me are coming from a greater source. And I've perceived and felt within my own being, I've not seen the temptation, which is my next opportunity. And I've almost kind of felt that almost like a little drawing back of spirit. I've now learned to recognize that's an opportunity for me to pause and get really still and get really curious what might be here just outside of the edges of my awareness that's ready to come in. So it's staying incredibly vigilant. You know, my whole life is love and the expression of that love and the atonement and everyone's collective realization of what's actually already true. But when we don't know it's true, it sure feels like what we think we're experiencing is really real to us. So my whole life is dedicated to it. I don't have regular schedules of like meditation or anything, because those are one of those subtle temptations that you can drop into that, oh, this little time assures me of this. And then I run off into my worldly consciousness, except in those times.
Right.
I've learned to stay very attentive to the body and to my breath. One of the sad things I think that happens with a lot of course students And I can understand why it happens. It's this, I'm not a body, I am free. Therefore, I'm as God created me. We like totally throw the body out. We then, our egoic mind deduces, well, then therefore, that must mean da 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 da. And we fill in a lot of blanks, which of course is never what Yeshua meant in, when he said it in the Course. So the body's a beautiful ally because it's always present and the body's always reflecting what's going on. The mind can, you know, get cognitive story and blah, 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 the meaning maker of the mind, but the body will reflect either peace or contraction.
Yes.
So being very present here with the body as an ally. So once the body gets repurposed to be spirit's tool, when he said the body's a communication device, he didn't mean for me to communicate to you. He meant for the spirit to communicate to your consciousness using the body as the mechanism if our mind isn't open. So the communication from spirit, the spirit can always use the body because the spirit, the mind is that which creates the body anyway. It's not the little thinking mind. So the spirit can get my attention with the body. Ah, I see that I have tension behind my shoulders. Let me take a breath and see where I'm in the mind and not resting back in spirit.
Yes.
So in the body is such a beautiful, because the body can't be in the past or future.
Right.
I mean, we can run everywhere in our minds, which can be fun and exciting. And even when you open to some greater consciousness, the mystical planes, it's tempting to go play out there all the time. But this is really about waking down into our bodies and embodying Christ consciousness here and now. I'm always a little challenged when I hear folks say, well, I can't wait to go home. Like it's another place.
I know.
It's not another place.
I want to get out of this world.
Yeah. Well, that's the world you need to forget. That's the one you're creating and seeing. But anyway, so I like the term waking down into the body. It's the descension of Christ consciousness to be lived here so that that invisible mystery of Christ consciousness or God or whatever you want to call it can be seen, can be realized, can be expressed, can be known by those who might still be choosing freely and innocently to deny truth for a little while. So those are some of the things that work for me.
Okay, first of all, before I continue, I just want to pause for a moment and I want to remind everyone in the room that this is live, which means if there's any questions you want to ask John Mark, you may. You can ask questions two ways. One is by putting up your hand, and of course I will turn the mic over to you. The other is by typing in the room, but I want to tell you that I'm not always watching the room because sometimes I'm watching John Mark, and I can't see both at the same time. And John Mark is a lot of fun to look at. So if you type it in the room, I might miss it, which might mean you may have to type it again if it scrolls away until I give it attention. But I am going back and forth from looking at John Mark and looking at you. So please, I'm sure he would actually like to know that there are other people here, and I'm not making this up. So.
It reminds me of my joy's full anyway. Why not? You and I are having a great time.
Yeah, we are having a great time.
They're welcome to join us if they want.
Now, I don't know what you know about. You know, you talked about the Course as if all of the people here know about the Course, and they actually do. Did you know that? Did you know that?
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Awakening Together.
Well,
okay.
Hallelujah and oh darn.
Oh darn. Yeah. Awakening Together actually was born out of a group of people who originally studied A Course in Miracles, and some of them still really only study A Course in Miracles, but most of them were beginning to also be called to other things, some of which you've mentioned, like The Way of Mastery, A Course of Love, another book called The Holy Spirit's Interpretation of the New Testament. But
oh,
you do know that.
And also,
I wasn't going to tell you that.
Ramana.
Yeah, and Inner Ramana. And as a result of Inner Ramana coming and me being a part of this group, people also then began to study Ramana Maharshi, Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, Robert Adams.
Cool.
Yeah, so it just kind of started to branch out. Even this morning I was sharing from one of Buddha's discourses, seeing the same truth, of course, over and over again. But that's what we call ourselves, awakening together. You know, we're awakening together with whatever is calling to us and speaking to us. But to say that the Course is our common foundation, that's at least where we all started, and that's what we all share would be a very honest statement of who we are. So we share that with you, which is really wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you for being diverse. Yet, of course, he says this isn't an end, it's actually a beginning. You know, we all don't, until we see the extent of our soul's journey, we have no idea what perfect little pebble. You know, you could have read it in the Course 100 times, but it said just a little differently by Robert Adams, and it, bing!
Yes.
And then, boom, you know, you have the aha, you have the revelation. So whatever someone's drawn to, you know, I've seen the Course almost held up like defense against other pathways or other expressions of truth, and always cringe a little bit. You know, the ocean welcomes every river. You know, every one of them is welcomed absolutely equally. In the Course in Miracles, it's just one river. I mean, he even said that in the Course. This is just one version.
Yes.
But, boy, we can do to the Course what we've done with everything else and say, no, this is the one way.
Well, yes, and I mean, that's really what the ego wants us to do. The ego, you know, wants us to take something that was meant to awaken us and, you know, somehow misuse it so that it doesn't.
Well, it can't not, but it can certainly manifest delay.
Delay, yeah.
We are masters of delay.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me see. Nobody is asking any questions yet. So that means right now it's all on me. Let me ask you a question. I'm going to ask you to describe the indescribable in a way, which I know is somewhat unfair, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm also going to ask you not to use certain words because they're coarse words and, you know, people may have already got ideas about what those words mean, right? So I want you to use a different set of words. I want you to describe who you are, who you really are, who we all are, right? Without using words like Christ consciousness, you know, those types of words. Can you tell us when you had this awakening and you realized who you are, and even though it came down into the body and became, you know, personified and lived, I mean, if I ask you, who are you, in a very honest way, and I'm not just someone on the street, you know, I'm really asking, who are you?
I would invite you to live with me and discover it for yourself.
Oh. That's my answer. You can't say that, John Mark. You're stealing my words. I always tell people, come see me. No, I understand. Yeah. But I do understand what you're saying.
And the first thing I would do is just sit with you in silence.
Yeah.
And let your mind fill with all the crap that it would fill with when presented with that opportunity and then met with nothing but silence. And after some period of time, the mind would empty itself to a degree enough that maybe a hug would be a good way to start.
Thank you.
And then from there, my awareness would fill with whatever would be perfect, but it's not something that, I could say infinite creative potential, but all that's going to do is fill somebody else's mind. I would rather than feel my peace and feel my joy and know that if they can feel those things within them, that mysterious truth must be also theirs.
Yeah, start to recognize the direct experience through proximity with someone who is very aware of that experience.
Yeah. So I wouldn't want to give them anything else, or all I would be doing was fuel their mind so their mind could go attempt to fake a behavioral matrix to attempt to outpicture what they think that means.
Yeah, I understand. Let me ask you this. Let's assume for a moment, because it certainly happens in some places, let's assume there's some faking happening because of enough reading, right?
Yeah.
I don't even know how to ask the question. Is there anything that you would suggest to help someone become aware of the faking? And then, you know, probably because it would be then embarrassing to realize I've been faking it, right? To get past that and to move on into something more sincere. Do you have anything to offer for that?
Well, I would eat the entire humble pie and get really self-honest, and I would share it with, I'd find someone to share it with, because those moments are really important thresholds where the mind realizing, oh gosh, I'm caught, will drop deeper into fear and separation as an attempt to be safe, when the true experience is to move forward in sharing and go, ah, look what I just saw and I just realized. I mean, I experienced much of that subtlety even after my awakening. And as I mentioned, I don't know what I haven't seen yet. I mean, I might look at listen to this 5 years from now and be like, holy cow, was I clueless as a bag of rocks. You know? So I would look at within their consciousness how often they have to self-reference as something they define as truth.
Okay, so let me word that differently. How often they have to self-reference. So you mean how often I have to say it? How often I have to tell people how peaceful I am? How often I have to tell people? Is that what you mean by self-reference?
That, but not just the others, doing it within your own mind. And watch for the anticipation of looking to the future about how you will act enlightened in certain situations.
Okay, so like we're having an awakening together retreat here in Colorado Springs in October. So if I'm imagining ahead how I'm going to act with everyone else so that they will perceive me in a certain way, that's a pretty good sign that I'm faking it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's a deeply attractive and it can be quite addicting one.
Yeah.
Especially if you manage to get around another group of people who are also faking it, and then everybody's winking at each other, going, we're going to allow each other to fake this because none of us want to be honest that we're faking it. And then you can actually get reflections back. I saw this when my teaching began. You get reflections back that go, oh, yeah, you are enlightened. And then that mask can become more, we can give it more reality.
Yeah.
And then we get more vested in it, and then you'll find yourself needing to defend it. Truth doesn't need any damn defense. But you'll find yourself needing to defend the self-perception of yourself as enlightened or as whatever. Always look for subtle comparisons, because all comparisons in your consciousness are the act of ego or the spiritual ego separating itself and now justifying it through its more holy perception of another.
Beautiful.
So all comparison.
Yeah, I'm more enlightened than her. Oh, no, he might be more enlightened than me. Right?
Yeah, any of that kind of stuff. All that comparison mojo is ripe. That's very low-hanging forgiveness fruit.
Yeah. Okay, I do see a question, so let's ask this question. This is from a friend of ours named Rayla.
Hi, Rayla.
The question, we actually have two questions, so after Rayla's, we'll come back to another. Rayla asked, how did you learn to waken down into the body? And by the way, she's typing hi back at you.
Oh, good. Thank you. I didn't learn how to do it. It's not something you learn. Because learning is rooted in mind. I don't know, I'll learn, and then from that learned matrix or behavioral mind strategy, I'll then act a new way. I was embodied by spirit. Knowingness came to live in the very structure of this body and mind, and it already knows. It doesn't have to learn. So if there was something I had to learn at that stage, it was abandoning learning and resting into at times very uncomfortable moments of not knowing and seeing the mind want to fill that empty not knowing with some enlightened concept and therefore extrapolate behavior. So it was much more organic and much more natural than learning.
And Rayla, if that led to another question, please feel free to type in your other question. Again, also, you guys can take the mic if you like.
That feverish activity in our mind, that picks up every book and has to read more, all of that is the ego. All of it is. It's insatiable desire to learn, and it's belief that in learning enough, it will get the prize.
Yeah.
I mean, you can learn enough to then, you know, delay your awakening even more, because then you get into this belief, I am awakened. I am, you know, whatever. And then you'll create a whole identity structure around that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which that's actually the harder one, the nut to crack, than the fear base. I mean, we're ready to get rid of our fear. But if our mind has now attached its own salvation to its new spiritual identity, it'll hold on to that death's door.
That's a great point. That's a great point. We're eager to get rid of suffering, but we're not eager to get rid of our enlightened self.
Yes. Our enlightened self, that little self. And there is a stage where that little aspect is illuminated. And I've seen, and it can be very tempting to just stop right there. That's kind of the happy dream stage. And that's perfectly okay to rest there. I mean, if sometimes when you realize how many lifetimes you've been doing this, damn, some rest might feel good. Yeah. I think he even mentions that in the course, the being rests now and gathers, but when they're ready to go on, they'll go with great and mighty companions.
Yes, and that happened for me. There came a state of, you know, happiness, peace, where the diligence then began to go to the wayside for a while because, you know, I wasn't suffering anymore.
Yeah, it's very tempting to do that. And it's nice to kind of take a deep breath there and just, I mean, because a lot has happened. A lot of healing has taken place. The journey's not over. Thankfully, hallelujah, the journey's never over.
Well, and in fact, that's when maybe something really shifted for me. I don't know exactly what I wanted before. I can't really state it. I didn't begin by perceiving myself as suffering, which is interesting. I perceived myself as happy. And in fact, when I started reading the course and Jesus said, "You're not happy," I yelled at the book, "Prove it." And that's when I started noticing all of my stress and my frustration and my annoyance, right? So I don't really know what I was doing. I wasn't looking for happiness. But at some point, once I did come to this more consistent, true happiness, and I took a break, as you describe it, and then noticed I was taking a break, then what awoke in me was wanting what I would call truth just for truth's sake.
Yeah, no longer to get anything, bring you anything
no.
or make you any different, but just an intrinsic thirst for truth.
Yeah, just wanting to know truth because it's true, period.
Yeah.
That's simple.
Yeah. And it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's I almost think God births that subtle, simple desire within us because that's the prerequisite with which God can then pour out the fulfillment of that desire eternally, you know?
Yeah.
And truth is so utterly simple.
Yes.
But it's so infinitely mysterious and ceaselessly complex in its expression. And it's just the most incredible paradox that it's never boring, but it's always true. It's just the coolest thing. I mean, I never could have conceived it on my own. You know, when my mind was in right or wrong, once my consciousness opened to be able to hold paradox with such joy and reverence rather than the stress of, well, is it this way or is it that way? Is it this thought system or that thought system? You know, thank hallelujah you get past thought systems.
All right, let me go back and see if Rayla's saying anything else. And then we also had a question from Dove. Rayla says, great answer, so she seems satisfied. Let's see. Dove had a question. Oh, his question is, do you see everything as perfect now?
It's not so much that I see it. I feel it and know it. It's really a very slippery slope because if everything's perfect, then, of course, perfect by its definition comes with the opposite of imperfection.
Oh, beautiful answer.
It's kind of like something that's beyond assessment. It's so whole, it's so rich in its truth, it's beyond needing to be, it's beyond perfection or imperfection.
Very.
And that's really a kind of a felt thing. It's not so much a seeing thing. Yeshua talks a lot about seeing, and he didn't go there with Helen much in the course because Helen was a little too frightened about it. But he gets to it in the course of love that it's about feeling. Feeling is how we know, not thinking. It's like if you get the feeling to go to the bathroom, in that mysterious feeling, you know whether you've got 15 minutes or you better pinch and run quickly and be unbuckling on the way. The feelings reveal a powerful truth within them when we no longer need to then relegate them to the symbols and distortions of the mind.
Well, so go ahead, and I have a question for you.
Okay. So deeper capacity in the embodiment is really reawakening the body's capacity to feel subtle energy and to feel things in such a way. And the feelings bring with them instant knowing without needing conceptualization.
Okay, I know exactly what you're speaking of, and I know how it can be misheard. So okay. let me ask a question again from someone who may mishear this, okay? So I feel guilty all the time.
Yeah, bullshit.
Okay, so, but, you know, seriously, I feel very guilty. So, yeah, not me, but, you know, but I know people who do. They feel guilty or they feel anxious or, and now we're talking about feelings or knowing. What's the difference between this feeling that I always have, I'm always anxious or I'm always guilty? What's the difference between that? Why don't I believe those feelings and what you're talking about? It's the same word.
Well, those feelings are revealing something to you.
Okay.
But I would encourage you to, or anyone in that state, to separate the pure data of the feeling from the mind's interpretation. What is the feeling in the body? What's the actual sensation? Rather than going, it's anxiety or I feel guilty. That's the mind's interpretation. That's its labeling of a neutral event. Let's get to the actual sensation in the body of the neutral event. And you might discover, I feel tightness in my chest. Well, that's a very different thing than I always feel guilty. The mind has taken a feeling state and put a label to it and now is living in the label. Mm-hmm. Rather than, let me get very curious and present with the raw data of this feeling, because it's when the mind activates, I feel guilty all the time, it'll drag in its database of all the reasons why that person's guilty. So beginning to separate the raw data of feeling from the mind's interpretation, then you can start to get curious, which is early in the process. I asked Yeshua, what if there was one thing I could do to support me, what would it be? And he said, welcome insatiable curiosity. Get really curious about the feeling state as an observer and a witness to, not a wallower in. There can be a very fine line between being present with an emotion or a feeling state and becoming it and then wallowing in it. So learn to witness, be present with the feelings, and let the feelings begin to reveal to you the communication that the Spirit's trying to get to you. Because oftentimes we're so unwilling to feel that we never get the Spirit's message in the feeling. We're living in this, oh, I'm always so guilty, I'm always so guilty. We're living in the interpretations in the mind.
In the head.
So the feelings keep coming because they've not been addressed. And then we try and get rid of the feelings by plastering words on it or course lessons, rather than being open and curious, wow, this feeling is revealing something to me. Rather than just trying to forgive it with words and make the feeling go away, what if I got really curious and, wow, I wonder what the Spirit's trying to reveal to me through this feeling. I wonder where my mind is closed and the Spirit is now manifesting it through an expression in my body. What if I got open about that and let it be revealed to me? What if I invited the Spirit? If you can't get it to me, bring it to me in some other way. Have somebody talk about it in front of me. Bring me a book. I don't care. Just help.
That's beautiful. You just tell Spirit. In fact, I remember saying these exact things. Please show me in a way that I will understand.
Yeah, the Spirit knows how to get your attention. You know, yeah. One of the worst things is to say, I will only get it through hearing the yes. Spirit's voice in my mind. That's like saying, okay, universe, you can't use your infinite creativity. I'm going to relegate it to one way. And that one way only.
Well, and as you know, I also heard a voice. However, that's not the only way I heard Spirit. Right?
Oh, no.
Right?
Oh, yeah. So I'd encourage everybody, cast open the doors and say, speak to me in billboards, movies, music, words. I mean, the Spirit was communicating to me out of my unconscious wife's mouth sometimes. I was like, oh, my God, it is everywhere.
Yes. Yes, very good. Okay, we have another question.
Okay,
so the question is...
Wait, thanks for inviting me.
Hey, you know what? I'm really happy I did. You're a lot of fun. But then we knew that. As soon as I said that, I thought, fun, that's exactly what you asked for, wasn't it? So of course you're going to be fun, if that's what you were seeking and wanting, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But you are a lot of fun. So we have another question here. Let's see. This is from someone I actually do not know. So I don't know it might be this person's first time in the room. You know, sometimes people just pop in and they don't even know what they're popping into, right? And the question is, may I ask, what exactly are we awakening to? Probably someone who really doesn't understand what we're here doing. So,
I mean, I can use words like our divinity, our eternal truth, peace, love, God, but those things really mean nothing. But when you awake to it, you'll know it.
Yeah.
And your own intrinsic knowing will be beyond dispute. It'll just be a solid kind of knowing in your being, balls to bones. So it's more like, what are we waking up from? That's much easier to define.
All right, let's do that then. I think he actually already left the room, but go ahead and answer, say that anyway. It might still be helpful.
Well, sure. Well, we're waking up from separation, from fear, from beliefs in mortality. We're waking up beyond the need for beliefs to identify a sense of self through conceptualization, which that's all beliefs are. We take our beingness, our eternalness, we add a lie to it, it becomes a belief. And then we live the lie. And we forget our being. So it's really letting go of all those lies, anything that has a beginning or an end or an opposite. And it's almost a process of extraction or detraction. You let go, you let go, you let go, you let go, you let go. And in some mysterious way, something is left that you can't define. You can't, I mean, we can try. We can point to it. No, that's you and I's joyful work, is to try and point to that in as many creative ways as we can until someone sees it for themselves.
Yeah. All right, let's see if we have any more questions. Let's see. Please let me know. I see people saying things like, this is great. I know that they're enjoying listening to you. And sometimes they're echoing things that you say. They're quoting you, like witness without wallowing and that kind of thing. So they are really listening and they are really enjoying. But please, again, everyone, if you have any questions at all, please feel free to ask the questions, because this is a wonderful opportunity that we have to hear someone else answer the questions in this joyous way. Let's see. All right, here is a question from my friend Jacqueline. Gangaji says, don't practice. How would you address practice?
There are points in the pathway where you do need to practice. You do need to do course lessons. You do need to be vigilant. You do need to get some structure in the mind where there hasn't been any. It's kind of like learning some discipline. Those are early in the stages of healing, and they're very important. But intrinsic in every practice is an intended or subtly desired outcome, a future enlightenment, a future something, a future this, a future that. So practicing can be, we can get addicted to the practice, not realizing it's full of denial of truth. But there are stages when it's important. It's really, you know, I have such great respect for Gangaji and some of these other kind of really well-known teachers, because, and if you watch them long enough, your mind will pick up, and I've seen it in my own expression, what sounds like great contradiction. Because there was a point in my pathway, the kind of spiritual ego teacher, who only wanted to give the answer that was the highest truth. But that's not what's most helpful for the person in that moment.
Right.
So when I learn to let go of that and let spirit communicate the best expression for that person in that moment, even my wife came to me and said, you're a friggin' liar. You say this to this person and this to this person. But I was giving each exactly what was right for them at the stage that they're at. Yeah. So we hear stuff like this, give up practice. Well, then, shit, I'm only on lesson 100. I'll put the thing down. Because the ego is always going to distort those through its own filter to get at what it wants. So practice is really important at certain stages until it becomes a need, and then it needs to be let go of and needs to be released. Yeshua talks about this in his pathways, about the danger of habits, you know, because we can have habits in all kinds of ways. So you'll know when a practice is getting too much for you. You'll feel a change in your being. It'll start to feel labored, or you'll turn towards it in a state of distress, and it will no longer bring you the peace that it once did. It's just like you've used that tool and it's no longer effective. That's the time when you open and go, okay, Spirit, what next? Rather than making enlightenment about a practice like meditation or anything else.
All right. And people are also commenting on my dog. They hear her. She was crying, but now she's laying down a little bit. So before I joined with you, I actually taught here in the room for an hour. So I've now been sitting here for about 2 hours, and my dog,
she wants some attention. Yeah,
yeah, she thinks it's time for me to get out. So hopefully, you know, but she's laying down right now, so maybe that will last a little bit. Let's see. Another question from Jacqueline. Is there any method of practice more helpful than another, or is that too highly individualized to say?
That is absolutely and unequivocally individualized. Everybody's got to do that. And if I could give one thing, don't chase what everybody else is practicing. That's a big ploy. Oh, so-and-so, they had this mystical experience. Now I got to go do that. And you abandon your own inner guidance.
So we shouldn't all mortgage our houses and go to India to the oneness blessing then.
No, of course not. Yeah. No, please don't do that. It's an absolutely individualized thing. You've got to do what works for you. I mean, and I think that's the beauty of what you were describing with this group we're gathering with now, is that there's great freedom for do that. It's not, hey, this is one dogma and one dogma only. So follow your intuition. And I would encourage you to follow that which gives you a sense of joy. If it's something that comes with drudgery up front, if you're having to work that hard to overcome internal resistance, you're just not ready. Or it's not the right thing for you. The things for my pathway that were the next stepping stones always were practices or things that were almost effortless. They didn't come with an extraordinary amount of mental pressure to do them.
Yeah, I still have what I call my morning time. I mean, when I get up and I wake up first, I spend about 30 minutes waking up, but then I go into contemplation, meditation, sometimes walking. I have this lovely stone circle in the backyard that I just walk. But I do, you know, I do whatever, but it is such a joy. And I also know this point each day when that has now ended and it's time to begin the day, you know.
Yeah.
And it is. It's just such a joy. It's so fulfilling. I absolutely love it. And I'm now about to go into a period of, I think, aloneness. I've had many people around the house for a long time, and now one by one they're all leaving. I'm going to be alone. And my heart is so excited about being alone.
Yes, yeah, I know that feeling.
I know that feeling.
I got on the road because they had been kind of coming and living with me for extended periods. Once we got on the road, I'm like,
yeah.
I mean, I had a great time. I really enjoyed doing that. There was some real kind of a deeper freedom from that.
Yeah. I'm really, and I don't know how long this period of being alone will last, but I'm really excited about that. So I did have another question here. Let's see.
I'm going to go have a pizza meditation when this finishes.
That's a good idea, yeah. Okay, I hope I'm not missing questions because it is scrolling. Lynn, I have a question from, actually, I think somebody else asked the question. My friend Lynn is just repeating it for me. She's doing a great job of helping me see other people's questions. So this question is, does meditation help us get closer to truth, or can I just be super aware in my everyday existence without meditating?
What's the difference?
Good question.
I mean, I have no idea what they perceive the difference between those two things to be. So, you know, unless I tune into that person specifically, I couldn't even begin to really answer that question. But meditation, like any practice, like walking a labyrinth, any practice can be beneficial. No practice ultimately brings you any closer to truth. but they can be helpful in removing barriers to truth. You know, if meditation is used and you learn to still your mind, well, you're going to have a significantly greater shot of seeing the truth with a still mind than one that's running around like crazy and is all over the place and you don't seem to have any control of whatsoever. But I would ask her a question. What do you do to be super aware all the time? That's really curious, because I wonder what activity or what thought system or what belief or what activity is running in your consciousness to manifest a super aware state.
All right. And so I think that you did ask the question, what is meditation to you? And the answer that we are being given is closing my eyes, ? So it sounds like when she says meditation, it's a sitting with the eyes closed. And then the super aware is as moving about the day. And if you want to answer the question that John Mark asked about, you know, what is super aware, I'll share that with him. Practicing mindfulness.
Well, if you're using the mind to be mindful, you may not realize it, but that is exhausting. It really is a lot of work. But there's a stage where that can be really, really helpful. But the true mindfulness is an eternal rested state of pure awareness that doesn't need, you can't turn it off, you can't turn it on, you can't super it, you can't unsuper it. It just is. Mysteriously. I don't know how it is, but it is. So I would also invite her to get curious about what agenda she might self-discover through some inquiry about a desire state to do one or the other, and then, of course, seek some kind of approval or recognition or acknowledgement from us or me outside of her to determine that. I mean, if I'd given her an answer, it's one or the other. Would she have taken that answer hook, line, and sinker?
Yeah.
If so, I wouldn't have been doing her any justice.
Like, what if you had said, you must meditate at least 2 hours per day. Would that then be believed? And
or would she be like, oh, shit, and then run to find somebody to tell her super awareness is the way? I mean, all of that's
right.
A game you really
either
need
way.
To ultimately stop playing.
All right. So, when I get up in the morning then, and here by I'm referring to anyone, not Regina. Okay, so when I get up in the morning then, what do I do? What do I do? How do I go about my day?
Well, do you need to pee? If so, go pee. Do you feel thirst in the body? You might go get a drink of water. You feel pasty in your mouth? You might brush your teeth.
And if you feel...
Any and all of these things... are super aware / meditation experiences of truth if we're really with them without efforting to be with them. I mean, for me, when awareness returns to the body, I immediately awaken in a very deep, deep, relaxed breath, and I remain there for a period of time. But like you, I can feel when it's over. It's not like I'm looking at a clock. It's not like I'm whatever. I can just feel, okay, and then
move
the day
now.
Starts moving.
That's right.
Yeah, not because I've conceptualized a strategy. It's much simpler than that. It's just this organic movement of being starts being.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, we're not having to think to get the heart to pump blood through the body. We don't have to really think and strategize and manage and organize and be super active with our minds for creation and life to just flow. It can do that very naturally, very peacefully, very effectively, quite miraculously, without us driving the process with our minds. So, ultimately, all of those things can be helpful, and they can also be traps. So, within the sovereignty of their own being and their communion with spirit, they're going to have to learn to discern for themselves. You know, if you're doing a practice and there was a suggestion to stop, I mean, like one time I was guided to share with someone, put the course down for 30 days. You know, they totally went into fear. Oh, I've made an idol out of this. I now have a need for this practice. And then we have an attachment to it. Maybe it's time to let it go. So.
Yeah.
Well, when I was doing my own thing, Yeshua had, he would have me like brush my teeth with the wrong hand, left hand, wipe my fanny the other way, drive places, directions I didn't go, because he was trying to show me how much discomfort the mind moves to when its patterns are disrupted.
Yeah.
Its likes, its preferences, its ease. And why it likes brushing the teeth with the right hand is because it doesn't have to be present to it. It can be running off whatever it wants while you're unconsciously doing it. But do it with your other hand. Now you've got to pay attention. You got to be there with it.
Yes.
So yeah. Any of those things can be good for a point or bad to a point. All of that is a manner of their own inner communion.
Yeah. So, again, each moment then really, I mean, you know, without maybe using the words, but each moment there needs to be this, what am I to do now, or what do I feel to do now, or, you know, instead of getting in the head, here's what needs to be done as a routine every day.
Yeah. Because the mind will tell us routine is safety, and structure is safety, and predictability is safety, and that's actually not, because then if that predictability gets challenged, ooh, shit, but then we go into fear.
Well, yes, I remember just watching a TV show once. I think it was some kid's TV show, some version of Cinderella, but the wicked stepmother, in this version, it was modern day, she was meditating and sitting there being so peaceful. She was rich. She had a guru helping her meditate. And then somebody came in and interrupted. And, right, she's all yelling at them immediately.
Yeah, so all that's going to, I mean, I'm so grateful that not one flavor fits all, which compels all of us to go within to our own inner teacher, and that's the only way. I mean, if there is one way, that's it. Is the inner teacher who knows your consciousness inside and out and can help unwind you from your little self.
Okay, we have several questions here. I'm trying to keep up with them all. One is from Yvonne. She says, hi, John Mark. Looking forward to joining with you next Sunday in Abiki.
Hey, and then good to see you or hear you, my friend. What's your question?
And all she says is, would you sit with me for a bit then?
You betcha. You absolutely betcha we will.
Let's see. I think I missed a question.
Tell her to bring a lawn chair.
Yeah, bring a lawn chair. Okay. All right, let's see. I might have missed a question from Uncle Buddy Black Crow. But if I did, can you
please? What a cool name. Yeah. Uncle Buddy Black Crow. I like that.
If you can, if I did, you can post that again. I see Dances has her hand up, so I'm actually going to let go of the mic and let Dances speak to you. So, Dances, the mic is yours.
This is my favorite, just silence.
Okay, you touched on something about, you know, making, I forget how you worded it, but about making the course an idol or the routine into rituals or whatever. And I had an experience where there was a group of us that met every morning online, same time every day. It was a fairly small group. Once in a while, there'd be a couple of extra here and there, but all of a sudden, one by one, these people moved just back to back, and the very next day, these new people that I had never met showed up in this group, and one of them, Brooke, I had commercial playing in the background, sorry. But the very next day, these new, they weren't new to the course, but these new people that I hadn't met showed up, and they were, like in so many ways, they were like the people who had left. They were moving and so forth and so on. Sorry, let me see if I can get this commercial to stop there. Sorry, that was distracting. And I went through a terrible, terrible grieving process because of my attachment to that daily thing. I enjoyed it so much. We all did. And then it was there every day, and then it wasn't. And And it doesn't have, I mean, that can be an example for anything, any kind of ritual, including that, like, even with AA, that I had memorized all these, you know, great quotes, and there's a section called the promises, and so forth and so on, and I had memorized them. They had become ritual. They had just become ritual, and I don't know how to put it into words, but I think you understand what I'm saying. It just became so, it just became idols, and I was worshiping the concepts, I guess, is really what that all brought about. What I'm trying to say is I realized I was worshiping the concepts, and I'm glad you touched on that.
Well, would you be willing to explore it a little bit?
Oh, wait, she can't hear you right now. One second. Okay, hold on. I'm going to take the mic back. I had also had the volume way up. You may have heard yourself so that we could hear her. All right, John Mark, do you want to go ahead and speak to her now?
Well, my question was, I wonder if she would be willing to explore a little deeper, because she obviously got a feeling state out of that routine and out of that regular communion with those beings. But the loss of that triggered fear, a feeling of loss. Do you recognize how you're giving circumstances and situations outside of you power over your state of being? Whenever we do that, whether it's with anything, that we give our power away to the weather, we give our power to all kinds of things. Whenever we give our power away to things outside of us, one, creating feeling states within us that we like, then we will inevitably, whether we're conscious of it or not, fear the loss. And we usually don't even recognize there's a fear until the loss happens. And thank gosh the spirit, you know, moved those people off so you could see, ah, look at this. I actually have an attachment to this. I'm letting this external thing be the determiner of my inner state of being. And that's just, anyone can begin to investigate where we're doing that. We usually don't see it until we have experienced a loss. Ultimately, we will realize we can't truly lose anything, because we always have the capacity within our beings to be present with and create the states of being that we want, regardless of situations and circumstances. So in addition to the idols, because we can make it then about the idol, oh, I got to get rid of the course. Well, maybe it's a deeper inquiry. Is where am I giving power to anything outside of me to create my state of being? So it's easy to go, oh, well, it's just the course. I can fix that one. But then this deeper thing of being enmeshed in a state of need or want with something outside of you can be left uninquired about or unseen.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, they're starting to ask lots of questions. And again, like I said, I may be missing some, so please be free to repeat. I have a question from a friend named Len. Do enlightened souls live harmlessly and are vegetarians?
I'm sorry, could you read that one more time? I was scratching my ear.
You were? Okay. Do enlightened souls live harmlessly and are vegetarians?
What you eat has nothing to do with the enlightenment of your soul. There is no universal law about food equaling a state of being. But you speak to the soul. The soul doesn't need to eat. The soul is. It's your aspect of what we might call the I am in the infinite consciousness. It's so whole and so radiant, nothing but the creation itself sustains it. So the question itself has got paradoxes in it that don't really make sense. But on the worldly level, I was guided through some diet changes on my pathway until I was healed that something outside of me, including food, could have any effect on me. And now my choices for food are made from joy and experienced in joy, not from a dogma of holiness or unholiness or righteousness or unrighteousness or healthy or unhealthy.
Yeah. Very good. Very good answer. Only about a month ago, I started being really attracted to what most people would call somewhat of a vegetarian diet, except still fish and dairy. Yesterday I had three pieces of meat. I was at a place where they had these skewers of meat, and I was eating the fish and the vegetables, and I had three pieces of the meat. So, yeah.
So, you may be guided through stuff. I have found that sometimes when there's maybe a new energetic threshold is being established, the body might move into what might be a state of kind of purification, lighter foods, less, whatever, but then that seems to become established, and then kind of appetite returns.
Yeah, so, this is my second time going through a vegetarian phase. I did it once before for a year, and then it ended very clearly when I still cooked meat for other people, and I was putting down the knives for the people who are going to eat meat, and I heard very clearly, put down a knife for yourself, you're going to eat meat. And I started eating meat, and then about a month ago, it just became unappetizing. I don't know how else to describe it. I look at it, and I don't want it.
And that's the thing. If we'll trust that, instead of trying to create a right-wrong matrix in our mind, if we'll just trust that, I mean, what are you drawn to? We'll eat that. And the spirit will draw your awareness to what else you might appear to need when you need it.
And you don't even need to know why, and you don't need to make up stories as to why. People have tried asking me questions like, do you think it's to fix something in your health? Do you think, and I don't know why. I only know that I've gone through these.
Care less why.
All
right. It's not like spirit is imposing a diet on you.
Right,
to be really clear, because I've seen this.
Yes.
Where we become victims of our spiritual guidance.
No.
Oh, well, spirit, I had to do this. This is much more natural and organic.
Yeah, like
what
I said, meat
Gina
has become unappetizing. I just don't want it, but the vegetables are so beautiful. And, those things are just, it's what I want. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right, I think we had a question again from Uncle Buddy Black Crow. Is the wish or desire for enlightenment a dualistic thing?
Yes and no. How's that?
That's a very dualistic answer.
It's a paradox. If you want to use the Course in Miracles thought system, the desire, what would it be like to be separate, arose. So all of creation is the endless expression of desire. Now, when we think we're separate bodies with our separate little wills, that can get really confusing. But ultimately, creation is a ceaseless exploration of more and more and more and more. So that desire for enlightenment, for truth, for peace, for whatever, is the first inklings of soul. And I really think God drops that pebble in the pond of our awareness so that then God can fulfill it. In the way of mastery, more so than any of his other pathways, he is very, very clear about the holiness of desire. Now, he defines desire as very different than want. Want, he defines as arising from a lack or a need. Desire is an expression of the soul in its fullness, seeking creative expression and experience. And he has a beautiful, beautiful practice in the way of mastery around desire. I think it's lesson number 4 in the way of the heart, where he helps uncover the deepest desire that we have once we've rifled through, I want a new house, I want a new this, I want a new that. When we get past all the form, then we tend to move into what we desire, emotional states. And then even deeper than that, we start to reveal the soul's true desire, the soul's true purpose. So for what that's worth, and I don't know whether to call him his first name, his second name, or his third name. So,
well, I don't really remember who Uncle Buddy Black Crow was. I know I knew it before, but I have forgotten. So I don't know, Uncle Buddy, if you want to remind me who you are. I'm sure I know you, but sometimes I get a little confused when people use these other names in here. Let's see. Here's a question from Jim. Could the desire for enlightenment simply be an affirmation that one is not enlightened? Is it possible that we are enlightened but unwilling unwilling to admit it for fear that others will attack us.
Of course that's possible. Anything's possible. But I would be very cautious of throwing that desire out in the attempt to, you know, metaphysically wrap up in that description. If the desire is there, I would trust that it has some purpose. And I'd be willing to give that desire some space in my being and see what happens. I would not throw out a desire because that one possibility, and just for while we're at it, when you have one of these things happen in your mind, oh, could this desire be? And then your mind starts rifling off like multiple choice possibilities. And at some point, you can very subtly pick, oh, that's the one. It's D. That's the one. When you don't recognize, the mind is just throwing up illusions. It's just making shit up, postulating possibilities until it finds one that will fulfill some unconscious desire that you haven't seen, maybe to slow you down or distract you or get what you want. And then it will use some unconscious choice mechanism to pick one of those multiple choices. And this can get very, very subtle, and it can get really, really slippery. But what makes D more truth than A or B or C? And investigate what's going on in your awareness that's trying to discern from those. And if you're doing that all on your own, that might be a really good time to go, you know what? I don't know what a thing is or is for. I wonder if I just turned to the spirit and got one thing instead of making up a multiple choice and picking it from myself. But for my own thing, I trusted desire. I learned to. I went through the stage where, ooh, desire's bad. You got to get rid of your desire body. That's all ego. And I was flat as a pancake.
Yeah. So the difference really is noticing the desires that are truly from lack, that you're trying to constantly fill yourself up from the outside. But then
I would call those needs.
Needs. But then the deep desire, like right now I mentioned, I'm going to be alone. I'm very excited to be alone. But for a few months before I knew that this was happening, I was finding myself desiring aloneness.
Yeah.
And now without me doing anything about it, people are moving out on their own. It's all win-win, you know?
Yeah.
But
cool.
I'm going to be alone, and I'm so excited. So I it's like you said, I trust this period of aloneness that's coming, you know, and I trusted the desire to be alone. Yeah.
Well, desire is of sire. It's of the Father.
Oh, very nice. Of sire. Yeah.
Desire is of the Father, like a horse siring an offspring. So oftentimes I've seen beings who are just, oh, I want God so bad, I want God so bad, I want God so bad, I want God so bad. What if that is God's desire, God's presence within you, and it's getting distorted, so the energy of wholeness, desire, wholeness hits. The body mind takes that energy, distorts it into I don't have it, and turns it into an insatiable longing. Maybe the longing is actually a distortion of a present fulfillment, but it's being miscreated. That energy is being distorted that will fuel seeking in the future, mm-hmm. rather than resting into what if this longing is God's longing for me, and what if I just rested in that and see what happens instead of taking that energy and now moving out with great seeking force.
Yeah. I understand that. I would love to spend more time on that. I think a lot of people could benefit from knowing the difference between the outward seeking and the inward resting that you keep referring to. But we have another hand up now. I had promised to let you go now. They're still active with questions. Are you okay to stay for a little longer?
We'll go until I feel it's time to go.
Okay. All right, then. Let's turn it to Dolores. Dolores, the mic is yours.
Hi, I had a question kind of going back to what Dance has said about her group. And I'm in a 12-step group, a recovery group, AA, NA. And I have this feeling of not attending meetings as much as I used to. And I'm involved with the MPP, a program here with Awakening Together. And so I'm conflicted about, because in the AA and NA, I'm sure you might know that It's kind of like a mantra. You must always go to meetings. If you get away, you'll use drugs and alcohol again. But I'm feeling the urge to not go as much, and I don't go as much. So, but I am involving myself in, I guess, spiritual pursuits. So letting go of the mic. Thank you.
All right. Let me take the mic back and see what you want to share with her. All right. I have the mic, Jean-Marc.
I guess my curiosity is, where's the conflict? You seem to be pretty clear about it. I mean, can you rest in the clarity? I recognize this thought system has a teaching. If you don't go to meetings, something bad's going to happen. But you're clear that you're not feeling that desire. Can you be with that clarity without feeling conflicted about it? There's no intrinsic need to be in conflict of it. For myself, I do perceive within AA that I'm once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic is a little bit of a short sight in terms of ultimate teachings. It's a fear-based way to teach. And when that work landed in human consciousness, that's what came, and it was perfect for its time. But nothing we've done in our past will ever define us. You know, whether it's set down the course or set down, you know, we're all still not in kindergarten, are we? You know, no, we graduate through things. We move through experiences. The temptation is to remain identified with that aspect of the mind, which is seeing a contrast between your own inner, I don't feel to go, and this outer reality, which is saying you have to, and allowing that to then create conflict instead of seeing the difference and then choosing, what am I going to do?
All right, thank you. Now, Peggy, I think you had a question as well that I think I missed. I'm going to try to scroll up and see if I can find it.
While you're doing that, I'm just going to go real quickly on clarity.
Okay, good.
Clarity is always present, always. I am angry. Well, you're perfectly clear about that. I'm confused. You're perfectly clear about that. I am in pain. I am hungry. You're perfectly clear about that. Our problem is that we judge the clarity as not being what it should be or what we want, and therefore we create doubt and confusion. So it's not that clarity is not present. It's always present. It's what we do with it because we don't like what's present that creates doubt and confusion. So clarity is always there. And if you can just rest in the clarity, I'm frightened. Okay. Just be really clear with that and rest right there, rather than move with the ego to this is bad, this is wrong, something's got to change, and then you get yourself into extraordinary confusion and effort. So clarity's always there. Sometimes it's maybe just resting, I'm confused, or I'm feeling conflict about these two things. I don't need to jump to guilt. I can see the contrast, and then I can choose.
All right, thank you. Now I have a question from Peggy. What if you wake up yearning, and I think she means in the morning, what if you wake up yearning to be present with presence and as a practice carve out or set aside time for study and contemplation, journaling, for as I do these things, I open to inner guidance. So maybe there's a little bit of concern based on the fact we were talking about routines earlier and not having routines. So
while it's working, work it. But don't think that's the only way it'll ever be. I mean, there were times I had some practices and I thought, oh my God, this is the Holy Grail. All I got to do is this forever. It'll have its stage and then it'll start to peter out. Because all of those things, I mean, so if she needs to journal and meditate in order to get into a state to get inner guidance, beautiful. Thank you. Please do that. But ideally, we want to live in a state that is guidance itself, that is the inner self, not something that we move towards by some ritual. We get the guidance and then we retreat back into our body-mindness and go do that. So you'll know when to put it down. It's like, you know, the medicine and stuff gets a really bad rap in the course and people feel really guilty for taking medicine. You know when it's time to take medicine, when you can put it down in peace. Not because you have to prove that you're holy, not because you have to prove that you're not an ego, not that you have to convince yourself or not feel guilty by taking it, you'll put it down when you're finished with it. And you'll know because you'll almost forget about it. It'll go in peace. So while these practices are effective, do them. But when they're ready to move on, even if you feel fear about them, let them go. They're temporary. The universe is great at taking away from us tools that no longer serve us and are imprisoning us. It's really, really good at that. So once something comes to an end, let it end. Yeshua talks a lot in the Way of Mastery about celebrating endings, not just beginnings. We like beginnings, but we're frightened about endings. And endings are actually just as creative as beginnings. So I'm not saying all practices are bad. I'm saying, like he did, be cautious and be guided in their use.
Yes, that's one thing I keep hearing you say. And that's the whole thing, is if we just listen with our head to the words, we can get very confused.
Of course.
But there's something within us that understands exactly what these words are saying. And that's what we need to listen to. So we listen to the words through our own within wisdom. Right.
Well, that within wisdom is the one in me speaking
right.
to the one in them.
All right. I think that we have got all of the questions now. I think I don't think I missed anyone. I scrolled up and I did my best to look very carefully. And I think we've covered everything, John Mark. So I guess we should prepare to close. And probably a really good thing to do, John Mark, I think maybe some people have fallen in love with you, and I don't blame them at all, because you're endearing.
I hope that they know it's themselves.
But if they want to know more about you, for example, you want to share about your website or anything like that that might be helpful to people, like you've talked a little bit about, now I know what you're talking about, but you just kind of tossed it out there, and they don't might not know about movies.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I did... I watched over 100 movies together with Yeshua in communion. And he used this as to fulfill number 3 of my pathway. I want this to be fun. And it also served the quick and painless. But he used movies with me because oftentimes our daily lives do not present us with situations that we can experience in a movie that will trigger something that we're not aware of. It can bring stuff up in our unconscious. So he used the movies to teach me primarily 3 things. How to witness the mind, how to slip into the Christ that's the eternal present witness, total innocence, non-judgment, and witness the mind. He used it to, when stuff would come up and I would get triggered or I would have judgments about the characters, we would pause and do radical inquiry about what was going on, what were my belief structures or thought structures that were manifesting those, and why was I trying to defend them. And then the third thing, which was really cool, was he used them in the context to open my spiritual vision. He spoke about for those who have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So he began to reveal to me these profound spiritual messages, which are right there in the movie if you've got the eye to see and the ears to hear. So he began to reveal to me what those were. And I was like, oh, my God, how did I miss this? That's the miracle. How did I miss it? It's been yelling at me, billboarding me my whole life, and I just didn't see it. So when my public work began, he invited me to share those movies. So on my website, there's 58 presently and these are modern movies like The Matrix and Lucy and Forrest Gump and, Truman Show, some obscure ones like Revolver and Cafe, but all of them are beautiful movies that he and I did in communion. And then of course, when I shared them, I was in communion in spirit to use the movie as a speed-up awakening mechanism, to watch the movies, learn to do those things, and let me share my spiritual vision with you through these that it might activate within you. And I get emails from people that, oh, my God, I went to the movie the other day, and it started happening for me. That's the whole point.
And tell them,
on my website.
You're saying my website, but tell them what your website is.
Okay, sure. It's onewhowakes.org, O-N-E. WHOWAKES.org.
Onewhowakes.org. And I didn't come in as an admin, but if someone who is an admin wants to type that out. Oh, someone did. Lynn typed that in for you.
Thanks, Lynn.
All right.
There's also some teachings on there called One Who Wakes Dialogues. Those are primarily teachings around the Course in Miracles. There's like 28 of them. They're absolutely brilliant. I really am so grateful that I've been part of that expression. There's a series there about the Way of Mastery, where I deepen every paragraph in the first section, the Way of the Heart, from the Way of Mastery. And there's also just a plethora of other cool stuff, like 400 audio channelings from Raj, Paul Tuttle, Yeshua channeling through him. Anyway, lot, and tons of other good stuff. It's really fun.
All right. So thank you, John Mark. They're saying thank you. Please come back again. Yeah, they very much enjoyed you, and you really are right up the Awakening Together alley, so I can see why they enjoyed you. I want to thank you very much for saying yes. When I wrote you, you had no idea who I was, and you said yes, and I really appreciate that. So
I had an idea who you were, but I was happy to say yes to you.
I thought you didn't, but all right. Well, thank you very much. Hopefully whatever you heard was, you know, good. And I
know what the truth is.
Yeah,
yes,
okay, good, good. All right, so I will email you tomorrow.
Okay, cool.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for letting me hang out with you and all your cool friends.
All right, thank you for coming.
Joy to all of you. Play well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. So I think he's going to go have some pizza now. I only have about 20 minutes before I'm on again. I actually have some pizza here, too. So I think I'm going to take a quick break, go eat a couple of pieces of pizza, and I'll be back in about 19 minutes for our daily quote. I'm not sure. I guess L-I-N Lynn is here to take the mic. I'll see you guys in about 20. All right? Bye.